Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 27, 2022. We have bright sunshine and cool temperatures this morning here in Nashville, and everything seems to be in bloom. As always, thanks to Ron Trammell and to the Cats Tribute Band for our bluesy intro music. Several years ago, when I first started this podcast, I made a list of people that I definitely wanted to interview. And as the podcast has developed, I have done many of those interviews, interspersed with new friends and new topics as opportunities presented themselves. At first, all the interviews were conducted in person, so people who were a five-hour drive away were difficult to arrange. Then the pandemic hit us and forced us to adapt to develop new means to record remote interviews. My guest today, Jennifer Bauer, is one such person from my initial list. For various reasons, we had not been able to schedule an interview until this week. Jennifer is truly one of the all-stars of the Tennessee State Park team and a trailbreaker for women working in the conservation field. Starting as a seasonal ranger naturalist some 40 years ago, she is now a park manager at Sycamore Shoals State Park. As you will hear, she combines her exquisite knowledge of natural ecology with a lifelong interest in cultural history. Her book, Roan Mountain, A History of an Appalachian Treasure, first published in 2011, is now in its second printing. And so I hope you'll enjoy my interview with Jennifer Bauer as we discuss her career in state parks and her observations about the beautiful place called Roan Mountain and the cultural programming at Sycamore Shoals State Park. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish six beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Jennifer Bauer, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Well, good morning. It's so good to talk to you.
Really, it's going to be fun. You know, I should say for our audience's benefit, you know, you and I talked about doing this interview 2 years ago or more before the pandemic. And back in those days, I was doing these interviews in live and in person here at the house. Mm-hmm. And so it was premised upon your traveling to Nashville sometime, which you do occasionally. And then of course that seemed to be out of the question. So thankfully we can do these interviews pretty well with the Zoom connection after we've had some bugs worked out of recording on Zoom. And I'm here in Nashville and you are at your home in Roan Mountain, Tennessee. Is that right?
That is exactly right. And as much as I have missed in-person meetings over COVID, I think a lot of people have, this is a good convenient way to do this. So it's a good plan.
Absolutely. You know, and this year, the Mark Fraley Podcast went international. I actually recorded an interview with a fellow in Ireland, which was about the Irish telephone system, which seems ridiculous. But nonetheless, it was a lot of fun to do. I know you are into family history, and this author is, I think, a cousin of mine. So it hasn't been well established, but by record keeping. But anyway, so it's great to see you and to catch up with you. Jennifer, you know, as we get started with these interviews, it's been customary for me to ask my guest a little bit about your history in the conservation field and maybe what about your childhood or your growing up inspired you to get into park management and to botany and natural resources management?
Well, that's a good question, and I probably have a very unlikely answer. I was raised in Maryland, in Baltimore County, and my mother was a World War II war bride, married my father, who was from Maryland after the war. And so that's where I was born and raised. And very little of my childhood was really wrapped around conservation at that time. So there must have been, my mom always said there was something about her past where she grew up in England, which was very natural in, the outdoors, and she lived out in areas that were not like being near the city of Baltimore, that she thinks maybe passed down to me through my genes. I don't
What
know.
part of England was she from?
Southeast England, most of her life she was in Bishop Stortford and those areas,
Okay,
near
okay.
the Suffolk coast.
Beautiful, beautiful there.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful country. I was fortunate enough to go when I was 16. She took me back home, her home, and it was a wonderful trip. Unfortunately, I was a crazy teenager then, and I didn't truly appreciate what I was seeing and what I was doing.
Do you plan to go back?
I hope so. I would love
Okay.
to.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of research on her life since, so it would be great.
Well, that's something that you and I share in common is interest in family history, but we're not here to talk about that necessarily
Right.
today. Maybe that's for another day.
That'll be another podcast, right? But I came to, after I got out of high school, I came to this area in Upper East Tennessee, and married my high school boyfriend, and that's how I ended up in Roan Mountain because his family was from the North Carolina side of the Roan. So that was one really nice favor he did for me back in those days because I would never, never probably have found this place on my own. And I really think that growing up in more of a suburb and type of environment close to the city, and then coming to a place like this that I had rarely experienced as a child, it was just this major wake-up call. That big wow goes off in your head, and you're in places that you've never seen that much. When my very best friend in high school came to visit me after I moved here, I picked her up at Tri-Cities Airport, brought her to my house. She got out of the car. I was living in Unicoi then and going to ETSU. She ran to a fence and she screamed, "Oh my gosh, what is that?" And I looked and I thought, "What is she looking at?" And then I said, "What?" And she said, "That." And I said, "The cows?"
Oh,
And it was just such a stark comparison to
right.
where people live and how. What they experience,
Right.
She'd never seen a cow in her
Oh my
whole life.
goodness. My goodness. Something else. So you came to East Tennessee initially to study at East Tennessee State University?
Yes, I started there about as soon as I arrived and started in elementary education. I thought I would enjoy teaching, and I love the educational aspect. I mean, that's why I love the job I have now, is a big part of it. And I just started taking a lot of different classes, learning things from professors that were totally new to me. And when I started out into the field with John Warden, who was my major professor, ended up being my major professor in botany in the biology department at ETSU, my thoughts started changing as to what was really of interest to me. And, his passion and inspiration for his field was really contagious. And he was such a great mentor to me. And he was actually the first person who suggested I work in the summers at Tennessee State Parks. So he guided me well along the way.
Well, Jennifer, I know you've had, I guess, approaching a 40-year career with the park system.
40 years this year.
Oh
I
my
don't
goodness.
believe it, but it's true.
Yeah. And so we'll get into some detail about that. But it's many of my guests that are in the park system started as seasonal workers. Was that the case with you?
It was my first summer was at Warriors Path. They used to call the seasonal position then a seasonal naturalist, and there were also seasonal recreators, and so they had different duties. And so I worked at Warrior's Path with Marty Silvers.
I wondered if Marty was there then, right?
Yes, he was. And oh my goodness, what a great introduction, to what the job was all about. It was really super. And then the second year I went up to Rome Mountain State Park as a seasonal naturalist.
Before we jump there, let's talk about Marty a little bit. I don't know Marty well. I've certainly met him and had business with him a time or two. But what a dedicated soul.
Oh, he certainly is. He from the moment I met him, which would be at least 40 years ago,
Right.
to this very day, his passion for conservation and education, especially reaching out to the young people in our world, is unparalleled. I mean, he is absolutely amazing, and he has touched so many lives. It's quite an inspiration to us all, I think.
So for folks who are traveling to East Tennessee, and if you get an opportunity to engage in a nature study program at Warriors Path State Park is where he's headquartered, please do it. Marty Silver is a Tennessee treasure. No question about it.
Oh, he certainly is. Absolutely.
So you worked with him at Warriors and then went on to be a seasonal at Roan Mountain State Park.
That's correct.
Now, Roan Mountain State Park opened as a state park in what year?
Let me think just a minute. It was dedicated, not dedicated, but it was created. The legislation to create the park was sometime in the 1950s.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact year it officially opened. After that, there was a process of building the visitor center and the
Right.
campground, and they had a small campground to start, which is now a picnic area.
Right.
And it slowly grew. When I went to work there in, oh my gracious, in the early 1980s, they had just opened the cabin area
Right.
that's so popular now.
Right. And
So,
that's when I first met you, as my recollection. I remember traveling to Roan Mountain to see those new cabins, and I guess I was on a trip with Walter Crowley or one of those people. For those that don't know about the cabins at Roan Mountain, they're really at one of the nicest, most beautiful facilities that we have in the state. Now, there have been cabins built since I left state government, but I remember those as being wonderful.
Oh, they are, and they've added 10 since then, so there's
Oh
now 30
my.
cabins up there.
Okay, well then there should be room for everybody.
That's right. Exactly.
So you worked as a seasonal at Roan Mountain, and tell us what you did as a seasonal there.
Well, as a seasonal naturalist, since there were also seasonal recreators, there was the opportunity to focus on nature-related programming of all kinds. Led lots of hikes and alprows, and I took a hankering to snakes pretty quick and started a collection of a few native species to show people. So it was that kind of work. And then, we worked together with the recreators on other types of programs at Roan Mountain. In those days, there were bands on weekends that played for the campers and the people in the community who wanted to come by. So there was a real fun mix of different activities for kids, adults, families, things for the 4th of July. You can just imagine.
Absolutely. I remember attending a fishing rodeo up there one year.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it was for kids only, but it was, for trout fishing
Yep.
in the stream there that runs through the Rhone.
And do you know they still do that?
Oh
It's the
boy.
annual trout tournament,
Okay.
and the Elks Lodge in Elizabethan helps to sponsor that. Yeah, it's still going strong.
Well, it was a great fun event. So you then decided to become full-time in state parks.
Well, I did. I've got to say, I was very, very blessed and fortunate to move into a full-time position. When I was first hired, I was in a ranger naturalist position, which became a commissioned position, and spent 21 years at Round Mountain State Park.
Okay, so before we just skip over that,
That 21 years.
no, not the 21-year part, the commissioned part.
Oh, yes.
So now we have a young lady who raised in Baltimore, came to the mountains to fulfill her dreams, and now she's carrying a gun around.
Was terribly unexpected, I suppose.
I wondered, and so they sent you to the police academy and
Yeah.
everything. Okay.
Yes.
Tell us about that
Yeah.
experience, Jennifer. You were among the first women Tennessee Rangers.
Actually, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know who came when exactly. Our chief ranger, Shane Petty, has done a lot of really good research on the history of state park rangers, and
Right.
he has looked into the ladies and who was the first and so forth. But yeah, I think I was one of the first five at least. And it was a challenge. It was not a place where women were always welcome, though some did and some did not.
Right.
And there were different, how should I put this, different perceptions of why a woman would want that type of job at the time. But it turned out to be a very successful venture and well worth kind of jumping into it at that time in history.
So, just to explore that aspect, because it's interesting to me that, I mean, you still are a commissioned officer,
Right.
and so that means you've got to go to the range every 6 months or so and requalify.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a dedication.
Oh, it is. I mean, you have to really, really love the job and the parks and the people to know that that's such an important part of the whole job, to make sure people are safe. If something happens, they have an accident of some kind, that there are personnel in the parks that can help them, that can stabilize them while they're getting to a hospital or whatever may happen. When you have
Exactly.
large groups of people congregating, you hope that everything's going to go well, and usually it does.
Right.
But there are those odd times that something unexpected will happen, and that's the one of the many importance of having rangers in parks.
Absolutely. Well, that's well said. Thank you for that. In the early days of your ventures there at Roan Mountain, you wrote your first book, or I guess is it a work? Is it a
It was a
workbook, or
book.
is it a, yeah,
No, it was
okay,
a book.
yeah,
I've got to say, writing a book was not in my radar at that
okay.
time. And the way that came together was just completely bizarre. I was writing.
Well, first, tell us the name of the book.
Oh, okay. The first book was called A Naturalist Teaching Manual. It came out in the 1980s, I believe. And at the time, I had just started, over a few years, Louise Zapp with the Tennessee Conservationists had reached out to me and asked if I would like to do some articles. In my mind, writing an article, if it even had pictures, to take up space, seemed very intimidating. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to take me a year to write this article. But I did. And I did a couple. They were about Roan Mountain in the wintertime, wildflowers, different things to that nature, history of the area. And one day I got a letter in the mail, and it had a copy of one of those articles folded up inside with a post-it note stuck to it that said, "How would you like to write a book for our Phalarope nature series?" And it was signed by the editor from Prentice Hall
Oh my
Press.
gosh.
I thought it was a joke. No way, right? There's no way. Well, to make a very long story short, this particular editor was devoted to finding new writers, illustrators, rather than, going with people that had worked hard to just try to get, a publishing company to look at their work. And so I thought about it long and hard, and though I was so stressed over writing the one article, I thought I would be a fool to turn
No
that
kidding.
down. So I started working on it, went through the process of outlines and samples and so on and so forth. And she hired a lady in Knoxville who's, I'm sorry to say, her name escapes me at the moment, but she hired her to do the illustrations. She had never been published either. And the book was completed. And of all things, I don't know if you remember the Foul Rope Nature series, but it was really
I don't.
popular in that time. There was a whole series of nature study kind of books that were coming from all over the United States. And they had four or five ready to publish. Mine got published, and then they dropped the
Oh
series.
my goodness. You know,
No.
in preparation for this interview, I made an attempt to find that book and could not find it anywhere in print.
Yeah, I'd say not. That's been
Yeah.
quite a while ago.
Right. But you do have a book in print now.
I do.
You
I
do,
sure
which I
do.
was able to get a copy of, called Roan Mountain: History of an Appalachian Treasure.
Yes, and that's the third edition of a book that started its process after the Prentice Hall book.
Right.
And it was first published, I first went to John F. Blair Company in Winston-Salem. They're no longer in business, but it was interesting because I had that first book published by Prentice Hall, and they were a national company. More publishers were interested to at least meet,
Right,
and
right.
see what was going on. So they were interested, I think, a lot because I had so many old pictures of Roan Mountain going back to about 1880, that they thought it would do very well. And so they picked it up the first time. They published 10,000 books and sold them all, but about 200, I guess. They usually did a title once, and if they had a good sale on it, then they wouldn't necessarily republish it. So I took it to another publisher, and subsequently the copy you have was done by History Press, now also part of Arcadia Publishing. They do a lot of great books on communities and so forth.
Yes, Natural History Press, exactly. Got it. Yeah.
So yeah, it just worked out really well. I don't know what I've done in life to deserve something like that, but
Well, it's
I'm
interesting,
thankful.
Jennifer, because we often talk about natural resources in this program and the plants and trees and forests and such as that. But we also talk about cultural resources, and
We
this
do.
book is a little bit of both.
It
So
is.
you've gone from a naturalist perspective to a cultural historian perspective. So tell us a little bit about the cultural history of the Rhone.
Oh, that's a good subject.
I
I
know
like
it is.
that
That's
one.
why I
Yeah.
ask. Yeah.
Well, when I, as I mentioned, my professor John Warden and his emphasis and influence in botany and the sciences and so forth. As I started learning about those things and what makes the Rhone so unique, so special, and so rare as a natural area, so to speak, learning about the people that had traversed through there over the years was especially interesting. And as I started acquiring photographs of the area, a dear friend of mine was walking across the top of Round Bald one day and just kind of bumped into the great grandson of General John Thomas Wilder, who was a Civil War general, and he had built the Cloudland Hotel on top of Rome Mountain in the late 1800s. You could just not even imagine a hotel on top of a mountain that tops out at
No, it's way up
6,285
there.
feet.
Exactly.
Yeah, and knowing that just took my mind in a thousand different directions, you know, wanting to learn about that, the impact on the natural features on the mountain. How did people get up there? What did they do when they were there? You know, who were the visitors? You know, how did the people in the community interact with the hotel and so forth? And that just turned into a lifetime of trying to learn more about the people history, because really our natural environment and the people that are interacting with it are going to affect, they're going to affect each other. They need to work in synchrony if at all possible.
Absolutely. Well, it's an interesting setup up there on the Rhone. So as you go there, the Rhone Mountain State Park as it exists today, I'm not going to say it's at the foot of the mountain, but it's down the mountain a good bit from the top of the mountain, as you described. That's what, 5,900 feet?
It's 6,285 at its
Okay, so.
highest point.
Yeah, so it's way up there. I guess it's a several mile drive from the park up to the top of the mountain.
I think it's like 8 or 9 miles,
Right.
something. It's not too far. 20 minutes in the car, I'd say.
And most of that land, if I'm not mistaken, as you go up the mountain, is in public ownership. So it's owned by the U.S. Forest Service or agencies of that variety. So you really do have a massive amount of public land there.
Really. And the state park is down at the 3,000 foot elevation. And as you go up, there's homes and farms, you know, as you start up.
Right.
But once you get closer and closer to the top, you're in Cherokee National Forest in Tennessee. And when you get to the very top of the run, the Appalachian Trail cuts right across the top. And if you cross over into North Carolina, you're in Pisgah National Forest.
So for a naturalist, that changing elevation as you go up the mountain presents layers and layers of ecotypes as you go up the mountain.
It really does.
Yeah.
And lots of rare and endangered species. The latest glaciation, excuse me, in our history was the Wisconsin, and it's believed that it pushed lots of species down to the south. There's also been evidence of the Fraser fir, which is a high elevation species. The red spruce and Fraser fir tend to grow together down in Florida. Even though the actual glaciers stopped somewhere in Pennsylvania, that cold and everything in front of the glaciers
Pushed
went
it back
south.
that way, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, very much an interesting zone of study, and there are a lot of folks involved, the Southern Appalachians Highlands Conservancy, the Forest Service, you know, they're all involved in preservation of that very unique habitat at all
Now, up, you
times.
know, up the showy thing, and the thing to always talk about when you go to the Rhone is the display of the rhododendron in the springtime.
Yes, and that's what a lot of people know it for. And
Right.
what's really fun about it is the Catawba Rhododendron Garden has been noted as being the second largest natural rhododendron garden in the world. I believe the largest was known to be in China. And a lot of people go up there and they think that they've been planted because they look so perfect. You
Right.
know?
It's now what now that is about to come into bloom here in the next several weeks, I would guess. It's a little later than we have blooms here in Middle Tennessee for certain.
Oh yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. And it's a hard guess. You know, you can kind of say the first day of summer around the 21st is of June, I'm sorry, is a good place to aim. But if you have a really warm spring, they'll come out earlier. If you have a lot of cold snaps later, the latest I can remember seeing them would have been around the 4th of July, and that particular year there was a
Goodness.
hard freeze in early June, and everything just came to a stop
Yeah,
there.
just goes to show you the difference in climate that you would have at that elevation.
Yes.
But let me just tell you, I've seen that a couple of times, and it is absolutely a breathtaking thing to see.
It is.
And so I certainly encourage anybody that's in that area to make a time to go there. Now it can be crowded up on top of that mountain when that thing is in bloom, because everybody wants to come see it.
Oh yeah.
But
I've always recommended people try to go up on weekdays rather than the
right.
weekends, and they'll have a little bit more space.
So Jennifer, there's been issues of management on top of that mountain, with preserving the bald aspect of it. And tell us about that.
Well, that's a long-going process that has been ever-changing through time, you might say. There are those that believe nature should take its course.
Right.
There are those that want to preserve, these endangered species that have been pushed down from up in Greenland and Canada and so forth back during the glacial periods. Those to do that, you need to preserve the grass balds. It's very unique, that expanse of grass balds from Carver's Gap out across Hump Mountain is a 14-ish or so miles, and you go across several balds as you're hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Right.
I feel like the general consensus is to preserve the balds, manage for endangered species, and try to keep those balds open using different methods. And the methods have changed over time.
So what is threatening is the natural succession of the forest, or is it invasive exotic plants? What is it
Well, I
that's
guess it's a
threatening it?
little bit of everything in this
Okay.
day and age. I mean, there are invasive exotic plants that creep up the side of the road, things that get carried on cars and on people and just start appearing. It's not a huge problem, but it's always going to be a problem just anywhere at this point in time. Usually the bigger concern has been the encroachment of trees up the side of the balds that just kind of start closing it in from the side, towards the top. So different management practices have come into place. I've seen spot spraying over the years. There's been different types of very sophisticated mowing equipment to get rid of invasive shrubs and different types of
They had
prickly
some sheep
briary.
grazing up there at one point, didn't they?
They did. There's
Yeah.
a gentleman by the name of Jamie Donaldson who put together a project where he was bringing goats up on the Rhone every year because he strongly believed, and I mean, this is a valid fact, that once people settled in that area, grazing was very common. People would just turn out whatever grazing animals they had and they'd free range, up on the mountain for most of the summer. So he, with the help of a friend, introduced alpine goats, and they were up there for years. He called it the Botany Goat Project.
Oh
And Friends of Rhone Mountain sponsored that project, and people would donate to taking care of the goats, and it was really great fun. And he would contain them in certain areas every year, and then go back and study the effects of the grazing when he moved them to different locations across the balds.
Well, did it work?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, grazing, did have an effect.
Super.
Yeah.
Super. Well, Jennifer, I want to skip ahead because we're now about halfway through our program, and I don't want to neglect what you're doing these days. So you took a step from working at Roan Mountain as a ranger naturalist. You took a step up into management and accepted the position as area manager at Sycamore Shoals State Park, which for our listeners is another state park there in Carter County, Tennessee. So tell us about that step in your life, what that presented in your mind and the opportunities it presented, and tell us about Sycamore Shoals.
I can sure do that. I moved from Round Mountain State Park to Sycamore Shoals State Historic Park in 2001. I was working for Herb Roberts, who was the area manager, as a park manager. So the parks are grouped into little areas, and there's someone over that particular grouping of parks. So I was working for him at Sycamore Shoals State Historic Park, and really have just relished getting involved in a history that is focused on the late 18th century. You know, this is down in colonial times when people were living in the colonies up and down, the English colonies up and down the seaboard. And once you cross the mountains, once you cross what is now the Appalachian Trail up there on the Rhone and other high peaks, you were moving away from the reign of King George III. He wasn't happy about that. And so our stories focus pretty much on the 1700s. This year in 2022, it has been 250 years since the Watauga Association, which was a group of citizens that came together to form a government, the first known government of free European people on the continent, where they developed law and order and every free man had a vote. First time it ever happened. This was 4 years before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It's remarkable. 250 years now. And we're actually moving into 8 years of 250-year anniversaries as we celebrate 3 years from now, 1775, when people came together with Judge Richard Henderson, and the Sycamore Shoals Treaty was formed as he traded land with the Cherokee and opened up the West into the Wilderness Road. The year after that, in 1776, the fort at Sycamore Shoals was attacked by Cherokee, who felt that this was a bad arrangement, and understandably so. I can see how that, you know, fell together in that place. Another 250 years when we get to 2026. And then ultimately, the story of the Overmountain Men during the American Revolution is part of Sycamore Shoals' story. They mustered at Sycamore Shoals as they went off in search of Patrick Ferguson, who had threatened to come to their settlement and lay waste to their country with fire and sword. And by the nature of the people that had settled there, I think they pretty much said, "I don't think so." And off they went. Mark, I've lost your audio.
There you go. Thank you for, I had it on mute there for a moment. Sycamore Shoals is an interesting place, and just to bring our listeners into the vision that you and I both share of what's there. This is a small park within the city limits of the city of Elizabethton, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And what do visitors see when they arrive at Sycamore Shoals?
When they arrive at Sycamore Shoals, if they come to the main park, the first thing they're going to see is a very large visitor center at the head of the park. And in that visitor center, we were fortunate to get a state capital project that created a state-of-the-art museum in that building that opened in 2013. It's an excellent, excellent museum. Of course, I would strongly recommend it, right?
Yes, that's something I have not seen. I remember before that, so...
Yeah. And yes, when they built the park opened in 1976 during the bicentennial, and their goal for such a big visitor center was to have a museum there. So the funding was a little late coming, but it came. So that was a good thing. We also have a really, really nice Tennessee State Parks gift shop there in the visitor center, and a big community room we call the gathering place that people can rent and use for different things. And then when you walk into the visitor center, there's this huge, huge plate glass window that overlooks the land behind the visitor center, which is actually the place, the land where the Overmountain men mustered, mm-hmm. where people lived, where people gathered. The Sycamore Shoals was a well-known gathering place in the community then. So
and it's called Sycamore Shoals because it's the shoals of the Watauga River?
That's right.
Right.
Yes.
So there's and a the beautiful scene of the river as it flows through.
Yeah. You have to walk down to the river to see it. But what you see is a recreation of Fort Watauga that was built based on an archaeological project that was done on the original fort site in the 1970s in preparation for the creation of the state park. So people truly walk in the footsteps of their ancestors there. It's a very spiritual and important place to so many people, and a great many of our guests who come because they have found out that one of their ancestors settled in the Watauga settlement, or one of their ancestors mustered with the Overmountain men. And it's really fascinating, and it's just a wonderful experience to talk to people and really feel their how proud they are of their people that came
before
them.
Do you have resources there at the park that will point those folks that are interested in exploring that aspect of their family to the appropriate place to do research on that?
We do in a minimal way. We have wanted to create a research library for the public. We have a small archives of documents and information. We have things that we let people sit and read at the park, mm-hmm. you know, that could be of help. A lot of people have found great success on sites like Ancestry.com and others that have different documents of interest from the history of that period. We sell a lot of books, you know, that help some. Gotcha. It just depends on who your ancestor is. And our staff is so passionate about this process that they're really helpful if people call or come by and they want to know how to learn more.
So Jennifer, you and I started following the activities at Sycamore Shoals 2 or 3 years ago, and I remember seeing lots of programming that was kind of living history sort of oriented, where staff members and volunteers would assume period costume and do demonstrations for the park visitors of the customs of those times. Talk about those things and the programming that you're doing there at Sycamore Shoals.
We have, I've got to brag on our staff. Everybody that works there loves this story, and they want to find different ways to tell it, and they all have their own ways. We do an enormous amount of programming through historic house tours. We are responsible for the John and Landon Carter Mansion and also the Sabine Hill State Historic Site. One was built 1775 to 1780 in Sabine Hill around 1818, give or take a couple of years. And so they have their own stories that warrant some really excellent programming. We do very large events. In January, we do Old Christmas at Fort Watauga. These are all living history events. We have living history events at the Carter Mansion. We're getting ready now for the siege of Fort Watauga that will be in May. And there are living historians that come to the park from all over the Southeast and beyond that want to tell the stories. And they have different skills. They can, you know, they demonstrate different things from weaving to firearms to hide tanning, you know, but whatever their personal interest is. And they bring so much research to the park when they come and visit with us on a weekend dressed in the clothes of the time. We also present in June each year, every weekend, Liberty, the Saga of Sycamore Shoals, which is Tennessee's official outdoor drama. This is the 43rd year of that production. So I wasn't here at the beginning for that one, but it's been going on a long time. And it's presented and organized by Friends of Sycamore Shoals, which is the friends group for our park, which is another wonderful, just wonderful group of people. You're still muted, Mark.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I have a squeaky chair here, and I'm trying to mute my microphone occasionally so that I can move around and not squeak.
You don't want to squeak.
So if people want to follow what's going on at Roan Mountain and Sycamore Shoals and or Sycamore Shoals, mm-hmm. Each of those friends groups has a Facebook page.
That's correct.
And you can sign up and they will prompt you with all kinds of activities and events that are going on there.
That's right. And the Tennessee State Parks, tnstateparks.com, you can go to that website and search for each park. I know at Sycamore Shoals, every single program that we do is posted under events and programming. Upcoming events, I believe, is the way it's listed. And some you need to register for, and other of those posts are informational. We have information at the park. And like you say, our friends groups have a couple of pages. One, the friends group has a website also. So if folks are interested, Excellent. You know, give us a holler. We can get that information to them.
So as we've come out of the pandemic and the restrictions that have been imposed upon park management and programming, it sounds like you've got some exciting things going on.
Well, we really do. And I think this year, you know, last year we tried to do things that were outdoors still, and anything that was involved as far as programming goes inside, we really cut back on. For instance, our house tours, you know, we'd open it to 6 people, mm-hmm. you know, and usually we open it to about 15. But now, you know, things are, let's all knock on wood, right? Things
Dynamite.
Are going well, and
Dynamite.
And we're back to, you know, what we've been doing. Friends of Roan Mountain just this past weekend had the 63rd annual Spring Roan Mountain Naturalist Rally, and it's the first time since the pandemic that they had their inside events in the conference center where people ate dinner together and there was a speaker. So, you know, things seem to be doing really well from that perspective.
Well, I noticed this morning someone posted something about a bird watching opportunity coming up on the Roan. Is that what's going on there?
That is. And that's all over the world. It's a global event. It's called the City Nature Challenge, and it is sponsored by or created by an organization called I, just the letter I, Naturalist. Mm-hmm. There's an app you can get in the App Store, and it's an app that's devoted to recording things that you see in nature, plants, animals, birds, you know, whatever it may be, to create a global biodiversity list for science and so forth to understand.
And so what's happening on Roan Mountain involved?
So Roan Mountain on, let's see, April the 30th, I believe. It's a Saturday at 8 a.m. There's a group from the Bristol Bird Club meeting at the Visitor Center at Roan Mountain State Park. I always tell people it's the water. People call it the water wheel building. As you're coming into the park on the left, there's a water wheel that turns. And so they're going to meet there, and they're going to prowl all over the Roan Mountain area and work their way up to the top of the mountain looking at birds.
Fantastic.
And then their findings will be through taking pictures. You enter your picture into the iNaturalist app and work on identification of species. So
fantastic. There's always something going on up there.
Yes, there is.
So Jennifer, let's bring it around as we close up. We've got just a few minutes left. To kind of put the other side of your career in place. You have been seasonal, you've been a ranger. Now you're into park management and the supervision of others and all those kinds of things that go along with being a park manager. Tell us about your decision to jump from the ranger status up to park manager status.
It was a hard decision because, as you know, I love being real hands-on with people and talking to people and sharing, excuse me, all of our park stories. That's just a big part of who I am. And I wasn't sure because it is very different. I spend more time in front of the computer than I do, in the field. I try to get that balance, between the two things. But, Mr. Roberts was talking to me about the position when he promoted, and he said to me that, in this position, you have the opportunity to be involved and really kind of frame or set a tone or a path for the park, where it needs to go, what needs to happen. And he was right. It was a very different way of looking at things. You go from, presenting things to planning to hopefully, make things better for the future and to inspire the people that work with you to really love what they're doing and realize the importance of our missions at all of our specific Tennessee state parks. And he was spot on. And so since I've been there, we have, created the museum that, we were talking about. I was really fortunate to be able to be a part of the restoration of Sabine Hill State Historic Site in Elizabethton. That house had stood on the hill and it was about to fall down when the Tennessee Historical Commission restored that place. And so, we were able to work with professionals in the field that have nothing to do with botany and biology.
Well,
it was.
that and you're also learning about the processes of state government and
Yes.
what is the building commission and what how a bill becomes a law and all that kind
Yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of steps, a lot of things to learn, and it's all fascinating. It's all very interesting. I do like the planning process. I like organization, and I think I realized that when I started just planning a program when I was a seasonal, thinking through what am I going to do, how am I going to do it, where am I going to go, and
So
it's just
Jennifer,
another step.
do we have young professionals in the field that are coming up through the ranks these days up there in East Tennessee, young naturalists and young cultural recreation interpreters coming
Oh,
up?
absolutely. Everybody is. They're at the top of their game. There are so many good people in the Tennessee State Park system, statewide. And, up here where we are in Area 6 in Upper Northeast Tennessee, all of our folks are just wonderful. They all have skills and talents and things that they're so good at that, state parks in Tennessee is on a roll and it's getting better all
Well, I
the
couldn't agree more. So as we wind up, Jennifer, I want to well, to do a little bit of promotion on your behalf and encourage people to get your book, Roan Mountain, History of an Appalachian Treasure. And that's in current print. You can get it at Amazon or in any of those kind of places. I guess the Tennessee State Parks gift shop would have it. That book has its own has its own Facebook page, as I've noticed, and it's a good page to subscribe to if you're into that, because there's often this is your means of sharing to the world things that are going on up on the mountain, and it's a good place to learn.
Yes, thank you. Yes, it is. I try to keep things going up there when there's programs and things to do, what the park's up to, and yeah, there's a
Thank you.
lot on it.
Well,
Thank you.
Jennifer, I want to thank you for being my guest today. It's been a joy to see you again.
You too. Thank you so
And I
much.
hope to be traveling up there in the next year or so. And when I do, I'll come and say hello.
That sounds great.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. It was good to talk to you.